In Clairton, kids on the playground suffer from asthma. In India, millions of people struggle to breathe because of vehicle exhaust. And in Chinese cities, commuters wear face masks to protect themselves from pollution so thick they can see it. It's not just an inconvenience. More people die early from the effects of dirty air each year than of AIDS, diabetes, and traffic accidents combined. A new book looks at the people and policies behind those numbers. Journalist Beth Gardner traveled around the world to research her book, Choked: Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And I talked with her about it by phone from London, where she lives. As you say in the beginning of the book, when people die, no one thinks of air pollution. And yet, around the world, to varying degrees, air pollution causes the early deaths of 7 million people annually. So why don't we think of air pollution when people die of stroke or heart attack?
I think there is this invisibility that people always talk about with air pollution. And part of that is you often can't see it. But I think there's also an invisibility in terms of the difficulty of really connecting cause and effect for us as non-scientists. And in fact, in any individual case, it is very hard to do that. You know, there may be some really extreme situations, but if I have a heart attack tomorrow, that might be because I've lived in London for 18 years and there's really bad diesel pollution here. But it might be because I don't go to the gym enough and, you know, maybe it's in my DNA or something. But what is very clear is that on a population level, as the pollution rates go up, rates of all kinds of illnesses, heart attack, stroke, of course, asthma and other kinds of breathing problems, many kinds of cancer, premature birth, dementia, Parkinson's disease, even diabetes goes up when air pollution goes up. So it is a very direct link, but it's hard to see it.
Well, let's talk about some of the places you visited to research air pollution and illustrate some of the problems. And I have to say, coming from a region here in southwestern Pennsylvania where coal and coal-fired power plants are still very much a presence, even I was flabbergasted about the practice of burning coal for heat and electricity in Poland and how much a part of the culture it is there. So what impact does that have on Poles and also on the rest of Europe?
Yeah, it has a huge effect. I mean, coal is a major part of the air pollution story around the world. Poland was sort of a window where I saw it. It's one of the most coal-dependent countries in the world, but you can travel elsewhere. People are burning coal in their homes for heat as well in China, in Russia, and elsewhere. In Poland, there's, you know, certainly are coal-fired power plants. They depend on coal for upwards of 90%, I think, of their electricity. And that is bad for air quality for sure. But what is sort of even more egregious is these home stoves. People are burning coal in their houses during the winter to keep warm in these sort of pretty low-tech furnaces, and it tends to be lower quality coal. You know, obviously a coal-fired power plant is not great environmentally speaking, but at least it, you know, has some kind of technology, some kind of scrubbers or filtration systems, whereas these home furnaces have absolutely nothing. It's just raw smoke going out into the air. And because it's a much lower burning temperature in a home environment rather than an industrial scale, some of the particles that might be incinerated in an industrial smokestack just float right out into the air. So, you know, it is awful in Poland. I mean, you just see these clouds of smoke coming out of chimney after chimney, and they hang over towns. But there's a real sense that it is part of the culture and part of the history. There's a lot of mythology around coal and a sense that it's what we have as Poles and what can never be taken away from us. A lot of those myths are really not at all grounded. In fact, the economies of modern energy are a lot different. The remaining coal that's mined in Poland is so deep in the ground that the companies that mine it lose money with every ton that they bring up. But nonetheless, it is sort of part of the Polish psyche, and it's also really seen as the fuel that's affordable. Whereas, you know, natural gas, a lot of that comes from Russia, so there's a fear of being dependent on Putin. You know, I think some of these things run very deep. But what I did see in Krakow, which was really inspiring, was that a group of citizens and activists there really decided a few years ago that they couldn't bear this anymore, and they started taking to the streets and protesting and petitioning. And eventually it led to a law passed in the regional legislature, which has just brought in the country's first ban on home burning of coal. So, you know, hopefully that will bring some health benefits to people who live in that city. And maybe it will show other parts of Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe that there are alternatives.
I want to talk about one other piece that you talk about in the book, being a contributor to air pollution, which is agriculture. You say it's responsible for about half of the man-made air pollution in the U.S., which was a surprise to me. You visited the San Joaquin Valley in California, where so much of our food in the U.S. comes from. What did you learn about how air pollution disproportionately impacts some people?
Air pollution affects everyone, but it is really true around the world. And whether you're talking about London or the San Joaquin Valley or LA or Pittsburgh, it disproportionately impacts the poor, and it disproportionately impacts people of color and communities of color. And that was really on vivid display in the San Joaquin Valley, which is a very, very economically bifurcated place. You have these huge agricultural companies and a small number of families who own a tremendous amount of land and the farming concerns there. And then you have a very large population of, you know, mostly pretty recent immigrants, many of whom are undocumented from Mexico and Latin America, and who are very, very poor, people who are working in the fields as migrant pickers, who suffer not just from air pollution, but from a whole multitude of other health stressors as well, whether it's pesticides that they're exposed to during field work, whether it's water pollution from runoff from some of these chemical fertilizers and things from the farms. But as is true everywhere, people who are poor tend to live in more undesirable places. And in the San Joaquin Valley, people who don't have money to afford better housing live near these huge mega dairies, which have thousands and thousands of cows confined in very small places. So you can imagine that there's a big issue with smell. And, you know, there's some more unusual contributors too, like this stuff, they call it silage. It's like green corn and it ferments. And that is what ultimately is fed to the livestock. But that fermentation process produces something called VOCs, volatile organic compounds, and they're released into the air and they combine with other pollutants from traffic and from other agricultural operations. And one thing that I learned about air pollution in the course of working on this book is that it's not always sort of like the stuff that comes out of the tailpipe and you breathe it and it's harmful. There are a lot of chemical reactions in the air. They call them secondary pollutants. You might not even be emitting the tiny particles that are the most dangerous, but through a combination of other pollutants that are emitted, they can combine and form those particles. So, you know, ammonia that comes off of farms and methane is a powerful climate pollutant, and these things can combine in different ways and become harmful to our health.
The Clean Air Act of 1970 is a landmark piece of legislation, remarkable for its bipartisan support. And as you say in the book, it's an example for many countries, including China, which are looking at ways to regulate pollution. But several times throughout the book, you do voice your concern about the policies of the current Trump administration and changes happening at the Environmental Protection Agency. What's your biggest concern there as regards air pollution?
What I came to understand in researching this book is the power of sort of slow incremental progress. And, you know, it has been a slog, but if you look at American air quality now compared to what it was when I was growing up in the early 1970s, I mean, it's a different world. And that didn't happen by accident. Cars didn't get cleaner by accident. Lead was not removed from gasoline by accident. That happened because of a long, hard fight, many fights over many years. And it happened because of regulation. I mean, I think, you know, looking particularly at the American story when it comes to air quality, is that it's really government power and the application of science-based regulation and even-handed enforcement of it that has brought us this progress over so many years. The Clean Air Act is a remarkable piece of legislation. And there are, you know, very rigorous studies that have found that has literally saved millions of American lives and trillions of dollars since 1970. and the benefits of all that health when it comes to, you know, health costs and productivity gains are literally dozens and dozens of times the money that was spent to bring those benefits. But I think that there's a little bit of a catch-22, which is that as the air gets cleaner and we don't sort of see the smog the way that people used to, it loses a political urgency. And living in London, where there is a real air quality problem, and a lot of it comes down to a failure of enforcement, that London and its European neighbors do not have a strong equivalent of the EPA. They don't have a strong piece of legislation like the Clean Air Act. So when I think about, you know, what concerns I'd have in terms of now, I think it is less focused on one particular, you know, regulation that's being rolled back. There are lots of them. And it's more focused on this sort of bigger picture of the power of the EPA to enforce the law and to make good regulations and to stay based in science, because that has been the strength of the EPA, I think, for decades. Its rules are very rigorously grounded in science. And I think that the Trump administration and, you know, the EPA appointees and leadership who come very directly from the fossil fuel industry and are now regulating that industry, I think they understand that because they have taken aim at the science and they've tried to undermine the authority of science. I think that's pretty dangerous.
A line from the end of your book that really struck me about air pollution is, this is not an insoluble puzzle, a problem to which we must resign ourselves. We know how to fix it. So what gives you hope that this will happen or is happening?
Well, I mean, I don't always feel hopeful, but, you know, sometimes I do. I certainly met a lot of people who really inspired me, you know, whether it was environmental activists in China or in Poland or in California, and people who really understand, you know, how air pollution is affecting their own health and their neighbor's health and the health of people they never will even meet. And they're really fighting for change. You know, I do think very much that air pollution is a hugely important issue and a hugely important story in its own right. But I think it gains an even greater power from its connections to climate change. I still think that it can feel climate change sort of abstract to people sometimes and distant and hard to grapple with. And I think air pollution, once you really understand what it's doing to you and your children and your parents, it's just more immediate, and I think it hits closer to home. And I think in that way, understanding it can help us start to think about the changes that we need to make to build a healthier world.
Well, thank you very much for your book and for talking with me.
Thank you for having me on. It was really a pleasure.
Beth Gardner is the author of Choked: Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution, released in the U.S. April 22nd. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.